This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. And in our 1 o'clock hour today, it's our Computers and You segment. We do this program once a month. We've got a couple of experts that we call upon to answer your questions about computers and the bugs that you may run into, the systems and other software that you may be interested in talking about, some of the hardware issues as well, some of the new things that are out there. We talk toys as well as some of the basics about problems and all that. And our guest in this segment this month is Peter Kimball. He joins us about once every other month. He's the education programmer and the lead faculty trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium of the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Long title, but a short story. He's here to talk about computers and to answer your questions. And we always get quite a few calls, so the earlier you call, the better. 1-800-222-9455, that's our toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, if you're in our local exchanges, 333-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Peter, good afternoon. Nice to see you again.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
Seems to we've done this about every last couple of months, in fact.
I think
Celeste
we have.
Seems to be conveniently away.
Well, I occasionally see Celeste.
That's occasionally, yes. But we always like to follow up a little on some of the new things that are happening, and we were discussing a little bit about how what people are maybe adjusting or not adjusting to Windows Vista, the newest of the Windows operating systems that have come out. And you mentioned that a lot of people are still sort of holding off on using that as their main system.
Well, that's certainly happening at the level of a lot of businesses where they have a choice. People who are buying most computers now new are getting Windows Vista pre-installed, whether it's coming from Dell or Hewlett-Packard or whomever. But a lot of the enterprise-level users are traditionally waiting until the first major roll-up of fixes and enhancements called a service pack, which is now expected, and Microsoft has announced it should be out in the first quarter of 2008.
So it takes that long to build up enough known problems to do something that thorough?
Well, in a sense, that's actually good news because that means there aren't any initial show-stopping bugs.
And it's taken a year, so.
And it has been almost a year.
Yeah.
And so the software works very well, but at the enterprise level, there's just sort of a feeling, let's wait until others have gotten the last little bugs and kinks out. Although there's never any such thing quite as the last bug.
Now, is there an option like that for non-enterprise, I mean, an everyday user like myself? If I go out and buy a laptop or a desktop, can I get XP?
There are, with a couple of companies, at least until the end of 2007, on some product lines. For example, I think both Dell and Hewlett-Packard, to mention two of the larger ones, have some of their product lines available. You can order either Windows Vista or Windows XP. Other product lines don't have that choice. What you can do, of course, if you've got a copy of XP from a prior machine, is install that on your new machine instead. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit more involved. You can't just plug it in and turn it on and run it. And then at some point, because you still have or should have gotten from the manufacturer the CD that has the Windows Vista software on it, you could then install that, download the patches and the service pack and such, and run with it. There's no question but that eventually everyone is going to tend to move towards Vista because it does have a lot of additional features. More will be added as we go along. It's just this transition time that takes a bit of time.
Are there things that people have to get used to? Are there things that have been a little strange for some people as they get used to Vista?
Oh, it's got a new look and a new feel, and once you get used to it, you actually enjoy it quite a bit. One of the reasons that it hasn't really taken off in terms of upgrading existing systems is because of the additional hardware requirements. You're not going to get a lot of the same response from your computer if it has to do a lot more work just to maintain the operating system. There's the new look, which is kind of cool, but not a reason to really go out and buy a new operating system. There are some features in some of the new products, some of the Microsoft Office products, and some of the Internet Explorer and other products that make good use of some of the capabilities of Windows Vista. And what's eventually going to happen, and it happens on the level of the Apple Macintosh as well as happens on the level of Windows machines, is that new versions of software eventually will come out and require some of the features of the new operating system to run.
So you will want Vista eventually.
Eventually, if you are going to be updating and upgrading software that is pretty much cutting-edge software such as Photoshop, processing photos, dealing with videos. A lot of people are now starting to use some very convenient and relatively easy-to-learn programs for taking all of their camcorder footage and burning it into DVDs so they can ship it out to friends and relatives and such.
When does Microsoft stop supporting XP?
That's a good question. I have not yet heard a date, or if I have, it's gone past me. They generally will continue to support it. Let's see. I think their standard policy is they'll have level one support for several years after they cease production, and second level support, meaning you can still get bug fixes and such for a few years past that. So I would suspect that for the next 4 or 5, maybe even slightly longer than 5 years, there will be support. You'll be able to keep patches and such.
You won't be left in the dirt.
The time will come when there aren't going to be any more enhancements or improvements in functioning, just eventually security patches if they discover more holes that have to be patched somehow.
Now, in the interest of equal time, where are we on the Mac right now? Is there any, what's the latest talk on the next system there?
Well, it's coming out next month. It's going to be
They're not going to OS 11 yet, are they?
No, it's going to be OS 10.5 Leopard.
Okay.
We're going to see if the Mac can change its spots or something. It's got a lot of nice features in it. Of course, you can get the whole slideshow about all of this, the whole Flash movie, by visiting the Apple site. And it's got additional security features. It's got additional convenience, search features. And as yet, there is no software out there that requires the use of or will require the use of the new Mac OS, although we're currently at something like with Tiger, we're at Mac OS 10.4.09 or 0.1. It's hard to keep track. And there actually are some software.
Eventually, they're going to run out of cats, you know.
That's true. And so I think that'll be the time when they have to move to OS 11.
All right.
And they'll hit some other member of the animal kingdom.
Let's hit the phones right now. Our numbers are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Our first caller today is on a combine this afternoon. Happy harvest and good afternoon.
Hi. Just a quick question on Vista. I use an old DOS spreadsheet program. Is it going to support DOS programs?
You can still run a command line in Vista. You can still get a DOS window up. It depends upon whether your program, the DOS program, tries to talk directly to the hardware or not. So I can't really tell you. There is a, and it's probably a less well-known program, I would guess. There is a program that you can download from Microsoft about whether your system is ready for Vista. It examines your hardware and says, well, you've got enough memory or you don't. You've got the right kind of hardware displays, etc., or you don't. And for commonly known software packages, a few thousand of them, it will actually give you some compatibility information. I'm not sure that you would find lesser widely used software, such as possibly the spreadsheet that you're using, listed there. If it's still being manufactured, a good place to check would be with the website of the company who developed the software, saying
it's been discontinued.
Okay.
For 20 years, I think.
Well, in that event, it really depends. If it tries to talk directly to the hardware, if it tries to send commands directly to a printer or directly to a screen, bypassing the standard protocols, that may not work. Are you running it currently using another
XP
version of Windows?
I'm using XP with it.
Okay,
yeah.
And you just launch a command line, like a what's called a DOS box, and just launch the program from
there? Well, I ended up putting an icon on, but it was basically going to a command line, and that's what it does.
I would say you've got a pretty good chance of that working for you. No guarantees, but if it's running under XP, it would have to be doing some really pretty strange things for XP to accept it and Vista to not.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thanks for your call. Now, do they make – I mean, maybe there may be somebody out there who may make like an emulator of some kind that can run that? Somebody who still knows that it exists after 20 years?
Well, the command line itself attempts to do that from Microsoft because it opens up a box that for all the world, a window that looks for all the world like the old DOS command line. Mm-hmm. But certain programs that try to address the hardware directly, bypassing Windows, some of that is going to be caught by the DOS window in Vista or in XP. Some of it may not be, and if there's anything that may not be, that's going to cause the error, and the system is just going to refuse to run that program.
Your calls are welcome for our computer guy, Peter Kimball, on our Computers and You segment of the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go now to Line 4 in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I'd like to know, I have two questions, actually. One, is there an active attempt to make the Internet available to people with disabilities? And two, whatever happened to the Internet, too? I kept hearing about it, how fast it was. It never really appeared. I wonder what happened. So if you could answer those two questions, please.
Yes, there is the short answer is yes to both. There is a continuing, ongoing emphasis on making Internet and Internet resources available, accessible to those with various disabilities. That doesn't mean that a lot of the websites are doing what they should to conform to those accessibility guidelines, but there are several sets of them. There's a lot of work that's being done, in fact, here at the University of Illinois as part of the Divisional of Rehabilitation Services, including programs that can check over websites and Microsoft Word documents, which of course may be on the web, and PowerPoint presentations, all sorts of other content, these programs developed not only here but elsewhere will check those and tell the author what areas they need to improve, what areas are giving them difficulties. So that is definitely underway. And if you do a search for on Google or elsewhere for the keywords accessibility and perhaps include a phrase if there's a particular, if it's a visual or a fine motor accessibility issue, include a phrase about that. You'll find a whole slew of references.
Does it have your voice print in the computer so that no one else can come along and steal everything you have?
There are some software programs that require that you identify yourself with these so-called biometric fingerprint scanners, for example, that are just attached to the keyboard. I'm unaware directly of any that look at the voice print, and if they did so, they would generally do so only as a initial login. Because trying to examine every phrase that was said, if you were using voice recognition, checking first to see is this an authorized person and then interpreting it and carrying out the command would just be probably too much overhead.
Yeah. Okay, what about the other one?
The Internet, too. It is widely used, but it is only used in much the same way the original Internet was many years ago. It is not accessible to the Internet community as a whole. It's used between various universities, University of Illinois being one of them, medical institutions, government, military. It's used initially both as a prototype to see how well high-demand content, video and real-time video conferencing, for example, can be handled.
Do you think someday it will be available to the general public?
Yes. It may not be called Internet 2 at that point, but there is a effort to get high-speed connections all the way to the so-called last mile, all the way to someone's home. That may, in some cases, some providers are actually going to the expense of running fiber optic line all the way up to the home.
Well, I know Comcast has had some problems with theirs. They've had to actually block some people because they claim some people are using the original Internet. They're online too long.
Again, there are always going to be abuses, but most Internet service providers, Comcast and is one, but of course there are many others, will, depending upon the fees that you pay them, throttle you down and limit you to a certain amount of material being transferred, something that doesn't really bother or isn't even noticeable to most users, but those who are doing an extremely high level of transfers may notice it. In many cases, those are people who don't even know that they're doing that. Their computers may have been compromised by some of the spammers and are sitting there sending out spam email and doing all sorts of stuff in the middle of the night, and other times as well. Part of what's sometimes referred to as a botnet for a web bot.
Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks for your call. On to line one now, and your question in Urbana for Peter Kimball.
Hi, thanks so much. Question about, I'm currently running Internet Explorer 7, which I love, but have a program through my work. I do some work at home. Their software program requires Internet Explorer 6 and won't allow you to use 7. So wondering, first of all, if I can downgrade. I don't really want to downgrade. If there's any possibility of running two versions of Internet Explorer or any other way to get around this problem.
Well, there is, unfortunately, as far as I know, no way of being able to have them both installed and running at the same time.
Okay.
You can regress back to Internet Explorer 6, and unless all of the various setup files have been purged, that's actually fairly easy to do. You simply go into the Settings Control Panel, Add Remove Programs, and you can remove Internet Explorer 7, and it will either at that time give you the option of going to 6, or else you can... Well, that's what it should do. It should give the option of saying, do you want to just roll back to version 6, assuming that your system had version 6 on it and then you had upgraded to 7.
Right. Yes, I think that's the case.
Okay.
What would I lose other than tabbed browsing, which is my favorite, from going back? Are there any
you would lose some of the additional security features that are in Internet Explorer 7, but as long as you keep your operating system updated, get all the Microsoft updates, keep your virus software updated, getting all those updates and, you know, maintaining a subscription. And don't do anything foolish like clicking on things that may be of dubious origin. You really aren't going to lose a great deal.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your call. We have an email question that came in from Bill, who wants to say that he's annoyed by all the error trapping in Vista. He's asking if there's a way to run in an expert mode, and if so, what's the downside, assuming your protection software is up to date?
I'm going to have to answer that in generalities. I've seen comments about all of the constant, you know, you've got this problem, you know, this error has come up. And I have not yet started running Vista in our teaching laboratories, at least for the rest of this academic year. We're going to stay with Windows XP, I think, and then make the big switch next year. So I can't speak directly from experience, but I have read that you can disable or inhibit many of those messages from appearing. You're no worse off than you really are in programs and software operating systems such as Windows XP, where you simply don't see those kinds of messages. The downside is if something were going on, you might not be aware of it, but then is that really an issue? Because if you get inundated by all of these various pop-ups and exception reports, you get to the point that you just click past them anyway without reading them. So,
right. I mean, this isn't a situation where they have a little checkbox on the bottom saying, do not show me this again.
I'm not entirely sure where that is done. I would suggest, let me just see if I can...
Disclaimer, yeah, the computer that you're using now is running Windows 2000. So.
Yeah, so there's not a whole lot that I can take a look at here.
A little bit behind the time, but not to say that you'd be finding error messages in Windows Vista.
Let's see, error handling messages. I would suspect that if you simply do a Google search, including as your phrases, Vista, error messages, disable, you will probably get, I didn't do mine quite granular enough, I've got 1.5 million hits, but I would suspect that you'd be able to find how you could turn off most of those or inhibit them. I don't know that there is a single checkbox that you can go ahead and click.
As there are many, many error messages.
Yes, coming from many different sources.
Right.
But the email also touched upon a very critical aspect, and that is whether or not you're running Vista, whether or not you're seeing all of these error messages and event trapping pop-ups saying, you know, this is about to happen, you definitely want to maintain not only safe computing practices, not clicking on errant attachments, for example, but also make sure that your antivirus and its protection is up to date, and be running a firewall. At the very least, the firewall that comes with Windows, but there are many other good shareware and freeware and, of course, commercial firewall programs as
well. And, of course, the other caveat there is you have to keep them updated.
That's true.
All right. Our show is Computers and You on the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest is Peter Kimball, who is a faculty trainer with the FAST 3 Consortium at the University of Illinois. Your calls, again, are welcome, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We'll try to handle the difficult questions. Easy questions are just as important as well because, you know, if you ask that question, there are another 50 people out there who might be asking the same question and think, gee, may be able to get that answer from Peter Kimball. A couple of things that we wanted to touch on in the absence of calls. One thing that caught me off guard is that there are vulnerabilities in using YouTube. That's something that almost all of us have come across now in finding videos on YouTube. But there are things that you have to watch out for as far as unauthorized use, people whose intentions aren't all that good.
There are, and I don't. It's certainly not unique to YouTube. Anything that becomes sufficiently popular is going to be an attractive target for the.
Not to mention any other video window, whatever Google uses, yes. Or that sort of thing.
And there was earlier in the summer, a security researcher got a little bit concerned that there were 30 or 40 different identified at the YouTube website, and he didn't think that Google was now the owner of YouTube was. Addressing them, so it got a little bit of publicity. Google is working on much of that. The same kinds of things that that lead to safe computing any place should be considered. One of the problems, for example, is from a link in YouTube, an underlying link under a video window click, and you may be taken to a place that looks like you're still on YouTube, but it may actually be a fake site that's trying to get some information from you, probing your system to see if there are any vulnerabilities and such. And that was a security problem at the level of YouTube, not only at the level of the user's action, but it was other sites were able to masquerade as YouTube and therefore would be trusted by the system as YouTube was. It's something that's called cross-site scripting. But even beyond that, some things that are in common, and it's just become more obvious in YouTube since it's become more popular, is when you visit some other site, make sure that the site that you think you're clicking on is where you're really going. Take a moment and look at that little address line down at the bottom of the browser if you've got it turned on in the status bar. And the reason for that is that more and more rogue websites will be loaded with all sorts of exploits, little viruses and trojans, which will, if they find any little gap in your protection, if you haven't updated your system with the latest patches, if you don't have the latest virus protection, they'll slip in and then invite all their friends.
How does that information get transmitted, and what's the end use for somebody who is looking for those vulnerabilities?
Well, there are two major ones now, and it's no longer the case as it was in the early days that, oh, we've got a virus and we're going to, you know, wipe out the computer just because we can do it and we're, you know, that'll teach you, ha-ha. Instead, there's a major profit motive now. There are billions of dollars being made from illicit websites and the sorts of things that they can accomplish. The worst of them probably are websites that install things like keyboard loggers so that when you're going about your normal business, perhaps online banking, not only are you logging into your online banking site, but this little program is making a record of what your site was, what your name was, what your password was. And of course, that's like telling somebody, hey, you know, I'm with the First National Bank. My password is secret. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got $10,000 in the account. So identity theft, monetary theft. And the other major area that is of concern is, as everybody knows, there's all kinds of spam mail that's being generated by hundreds of thousands or millions of machines, and many of those are being generated by computers owned in all innocence by people who just have a machine sitting at home. They're maybe connected via a fast internet connection, cable modem, or a DSL line, and they have become infected with a program that essentially lets that computer sit there and churn out tens of thousands of spam emails per day.
Now, that's, I mean, having, using your computer, your constantly online computer for other uses is something that's been used for good in some cases as well. I remember the old SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where they would, you would be able to sign up, and in the off, you know, the computing power that your computer is not using at the time can be used by this project.
And the key there, of course, is that you sign up for it, decide to do that,
right?
And the programs such as the SETI search, and now there are several others that you can do, including searches
like AIDS for, research and a couple of other places,
doing molecular, your own little bit of the computation that with millions of others can actually result in significant accomplishments.
But that's being used in bad situations as well.
Yes, and it's being used without your permission and without, in many cases, consideration of other things you're doing. Programs such as the SETI or the medical research distributed computing programs generally throttle themselves down or stop running when you're doing anything on the computer. They're just being used and activate themselves when things are idle, so much as like a screensaver perhaps. And the various Trojans and web bots and spamming engines run all the time. And that is one reason, not the only reason certainly, that people find after a while their machines start slowing down. Now,
right.
It could be more innocuous than that. It could just be there's lots of, you know, adware and other kinds of stuff going on in there.
Now, what protects those shared computing programs from the same kind of vulnerabilities that are hitting your computer?
Well, if you're asking, once a computer has been compromised, it turns out that a number of these software developers doing the so-called malware, the malicious software developers, actually have somewhat famously included detection engines to find their competitors and knock them off.
No kidding.
So it's sort of like a, you know, it's
spy versus
two or three,
spy.
Yeah, spy versus spy, all fighting for control of yours and a few tenths of thousands of others' computers.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Again, our number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. A caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon. Hello, Champaign.
Hi, yes. I was really glad you brought up this last point about people being hooked up all the time to the net. It just seems to me like for most computers, that's insane. That's an incredible security breach, I guess you'd say, or at least there's the opportunity for security breaches. Why would anybody possibly leave their computer online all the time? Is there an advantage? And I'd like you to go ahead and talk about the disadvantages of doing that. Now, I'm an Apple guy, and there are significantly fewer viruses and spyware and other things directed toward the Apple world, and even I never would leave my computer permanently connected to the net. When I'm done working on the net, I go ahead and log off every single time, and I view that as a security plus. So I'd just like to hear your perspective on that and maybe justify why would somebody, except for these things like the SETI program that you mentioned, why would somebody want to leave their computer connected all the time, and is it really a big security bonus to go ahead and disconnect if you're not actually online? And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Well, it's certainly true that the most secure computer on the net is one that's not on the net. And so you can't beat that security. When you're not connected, when you're not online, obviously nothing is going to come in. As to why people do it, it's convenience primarily. Compare it to the old days when you had to dial up and it was, you know, a minute, maybe a minute and a half before you had a connection with the old dial-up modems. People have just gotten used to, especially in work environments, being able to go and click check their email without having to wait a minute or two. Is that worthwhile? Well, I would tend to agree with the caller. This does seem a little bit too convenient and ignoring a few of the security and environmental issues as well. There are, I haven't seen the latest figures, but as of a couple of years ago, the number of PC monitors left on all the time, this was especially true of the old television cathode ray tube type monitors, but it's to some extent true even of the LCD panels, required the power output of the equivalent of three or four nuclear power stations.
This is even when it's
just in the U.S.
In sleep mode or anything like that?
Well, because in sleep mode, they're not entirely in sleep mode,
of
because
course.
They have to be able to wake up, so they have to maintain, you know, a little bit of heat to the filament, etc. However, you don't have to be insecure, if you do leave it on for whatever reason, assuming that you've got appropriate virus protection, that you have a good firewall, it's certainly not as safe as closing the door and disconnecting.
All right.
He'd mentioned the advantages and disadvantages, not only for Windows, which is, of course, the still the major computing platform, but the Macintosh. And the same thing, but to a slightly lesser extent, applies to the Macintosh. There aren't as many exploits, but there are dozens or hundreds, as opposed perhaps to thousands. And the same kind of safe computing has to be kept in mind by users of any computer system.
How about just leaving the machine on all the time versus shutting down, booting up, shutting down, booting? Is there a loss of life on either one of those options, or is there one that's preferable?
I think for the most case, it's thought to be kind of a wash. There is a certain advantage in terms of some of the solid-state components to leaving it on all the time, because they don't have that initial surge of current when the power is first turned on. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to measure that? I doubt it. Individual variations would overwhelm any statistical norms. Things like hard drives, of course, have mechanical moving parts. The bearings in the motor and such are going to tend to fail more if they are left on all the time. But if you're looking at so-called mean time before failure of 50,000 hours, it probably doesn't matter. Your hard drive is going to, and the computer is going to be obsolete before you log that amount of time anyway.
All right. Line two now. Let's have another call. Ian Urbana, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hardware question.
Mm-hmm.
My machine, which is not all that old, has a PCI slot, and lately I've learned, while I was digging around trying to accomplish some other things, that there are now a thing called a PCI Express card, which I know the PCI Express card will not work in the PCI slot, right?
Yes.
Now, but will a PCI card work in a PCI Express slot? Is there a, you know, can you go backwards if you want to, but not forwards?
Well, good, meaning? Yes.
Yes?
Good. Oh, no, I said yes, good question.
Okay.
Hang on a second. Let me see. I'm just taking a look at this, see if it's reverse compatible. Mm-hmm. And my guess is, boy, I haven't dealt with... of course, PCIe, PCI Express, was designed to try to extend the life of PCI. And can we? Let's see. I'm not quite finding it at this moment, PCI Express.
It'd be nice to know if you could use the old system and the new system.
I'm going to back up and just tell you, I'm just taking a look at this really long article in Wikipedia about PCI Express to see if I could get any specific details about backwards compatibility, and I'm not finding it. Okay, let's see. PCI will physically... I'm finding not the information in the time that I've got here.
Okay, never mind.
It is not possible to place a physically larger PCIe card into a smaller slot, but that's obvious from the geometry.
Right.
Even though if it were possible, they would be signal compatible, but it's not mentioning the old standard PCI here.
Well, I'll dig around and find out.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks for your call, too, but we couldn't get an answer right there, but hope you find your answer. Line number one, next call right now in Urbana. Good afternoon.
There's perhaps a very low-tech reason for not leaving your computer on continuously, at least in this area where we have violent thunderstorms from time to time most years.
Good point.
That is certainly true, and anybody, whether they've got a computer that's connected all the time or even if they've got one and they're dialing up, still short of physically unplugging it, mm-hmm. not only from the power but also whatever connection you have to either via telephone or via the cable modem, short of doing that, you're still vulnerable to lightning and other electrical disturbances, and it's a very small investment in a power supply that will filter a so-called surge suppressor that can help protect that. Now, nothing you can buy is going to protect you from a direct lightning hit on your home. It's going to, if lightning has just traveled through 5 miles of atmosphere, a few inches of plastic isn't going to stop it. But there are other problems to be aware of as well, and that is sometimes the electrical supply, if a transformer someplace fails, there could be little surges that come in that can also cause problems. And if the power drops for a few tenths of a second, everything restarts. And if that happens several times, that's not good as well. So your point is well taken. Not leaving it on, especially in thunderstorm season, and whether or not you do leave it on, even if you do unplug it religiously, because just turning it off doesn't quite do it all the time, having a surge protector.
I have a battery backup. And it's remarkable how many micro pauses there are in our electricity.
Yes, and that's actually a fairly good way of going as well, although it's a bit more expensive than just a surge protector.
A UPS.
Yes, an uninterruptible power supply. Mm-hmm. And normally the power supply in the computer, the capacitors and such, will be able to weather those little micro drops.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a thousandth of a second, really not much is going to happen, except there's oftentimes a little bit of a spike right after that thousandth of a second. So, but yes, that's also an excellent approach.
Well, I unplug it anyway when there's a storm imminent, but the power supply as well. But thanks for the program. It's always so informative.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. It always comes down to the comfort level.
It does. There's one thing. It's sort of interesting. It happened to me a number of years ago. We were having a thunderstorm. I'd unplugged my computer entirely. It was totally unplugged from the wall. It had no connections at all.
Uh-huh.
What I did have is a special cable that was about, probably 30 feet long, normally longer than you would have, between my computer and the printer. It did not connect into the power. It just connected between them.
And the printer was plugged in.
The printer was not plugged in.
Oh, okay.
Nothing was plugged in. But there was a nearby lightning bolt, and I'd had this little cable, the extra part of it, coiled up, and I got enough of an inductive voltage in there to fry the printer card.
Wow.
I was sitting in there, heard this crack and boom outside, heard a little inside the computer. I said, wait a minute, that can't happen. And I looked and I could actually see where there was a little electrical arc that had hit the inside of the metal case.
So
this
you're
was back
never, ever, ever safe, I guess.
I guess not.
All right. Let's go to line 3 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to comment on the PCI versus PCI Express.
Ah, yes. Thank you.
PCI and PCI Express are wholly incompatible.
Okay. We knew they were incompatible one way, but I'm glad you confirmed they're incompatible the other direction as well.
The voltages are different. The protocol for the speaking between the cards and the host are different. I think PCI and PCI Express are mostly interchangeable. Or not PCI Express, PCI X. PCI X was designed to give extra life to PCI.
Okay.
They use faster signaling frequencies and wider bus. I think they went up to 64-bit wide data path on the PCIX slots.
Uh-huh.
And you could plug some PCIX cards into PCI slots, and they would just run slower. And
sure.
You can plug some PCI cards into PCIX slots, and you just wouldn't see any benefit.
And then, of course, after PCIX, kind of an interim, along came PCI Express, which is completely different design, as you say.
Yeah. Wholly different.
Okay.
Interesting why they wouldn't have named it something completely different other than PCI Express, though.
Well, I think that the issue was just that they were running into the limits of what they could do with the old standard. It was designed for applications where they weren't transmitting a whole lot of data between the cards and the CPU.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to redesign it from scratch, essentially, to get any more bandwidth out of it.
Because there's a lot more demand these days, not just for video gaming, but for any kind of video applications, to get that information back and forth between the computer and the card.
And network throughput. I mean, when you're talking about like gigabit Ethernet, which is the latest and greatest, Ethernet standard, you run into a lot of problems, trying to push, all the data back and forth to the disks and then back and forth to the network card to send it out, to the rest of the computers on the network. You can saturate a PCI bus without even trying, and that's an environment.
Yeah, and PCI was... they stopped really doing new PCI. It's, 4 or 5 years ago now at least, isn't it?
Yeah, you can still get it as sort of a legacy port or a slot available on modern motherboards just because hasn't really caught on with a lot of the peripherals, and it's not cheap yet. Oh, also with the disconnecting your computer from the internet when you're not using it.
Yes.
I've found that if you've got a firewall and you've got antivirus software, you're about as protected as you're going to get. Most of the problems that people run into don't come from hackers or worms coming in through the internet connection. It's the user opening the attachments in the emails.
Right. That's for sure.
Not doing the Windows updates. That's the biggest thing is really with Microsoft products is just update the software. Microsoft comes out with patches all the time. And if you don't download those and install them through their really simple system, you're going to find yourself with a computer that's more or less unusable really quickly.
And there's a small reason why maybe it's better to turn your computer off all the time is because, at least in my version that runs XP, when you turn it off, it'll automatically install those automatic updates that you get and don't know about.
Although you can set those to happen.
True.
Yes.
They will download and install automatically without any user input, and they'll even reboot your computer,
right,
at 3 in the morning if you tell it to. And
hopefully they don't do that while it's in use.
Well, it'll warn you. It'll pop up a box that says, we're going to restart your computer unless you click this annoying box and make it go away.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I had.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the follow-up on the PCI versus PCIe versus PCIX.
No problem.
Thanks for your call. I'm still surprised that they couldn't have found another name, something that's not PCI, or it was PCI a brand name they had.
It certainly had some consumer awareness,
right?
Because people were at one point.
I think of PCI. I think of a PCI slot on a computer, and I don't think of it as a franchise, as a brand name. So. We're about ready to wrap up, and we do thank people who call not only to have their questions answered, but for sharing of advice as well. One last thing that you had brought in, an interesting news item from the past week or so, that Facebook, which a lot of people on college campuses are used to, is a site to communicate with other people and be online, is changing its policy, and some say maybe not for the better.
Yes, they essentially had defined themselves as being sort of a famous statement, a walled garden. What goes on inside Facebook is not accessible to the rest of the world other than other Facebook users.
You can't Google a name and find Facebook entry.
That is changing because they are going to be opening Facebook up to search engines such as Google. Now, they're not going to return a whole lot of information. If you do a search, it'll return the name and the thumbnail picture, and that's about it. And then you would have to be a Facebook member, which is, of course, almost a trivial thing to become, to go in and see the rest. And there's a mixed reaction to this. Some people think that, this should really have been kept private, and so this is just subject to all sorts of abuse because who knows what people have been putting up on their Facebook
But it's also got some practical.
It's got some very practical purposes. One interesting aspect is one columnist in particular said, I have some issues with this, but it is Facebook. It is a social networking site, and because it's likely that the Facebook pages will start appearing fairly high in the list of people's search results when they search for a particular name.
Because Facebook would put that up there, right?
Would they
pay for it, perhaps? Or?
They won't pay for it, but it'll just be a very popular sort of thing, and Google's likely to bring it up near the top. Mm-hmm. And that means that since you're in control of your own Facebook page, as opposed to what other people may have written about you, on other pages, that you've got a little bit more control over what people are going to see about you first. This, especially for the generation that is growing up with Facebook and MySpace and all the rest, has become a huge issue. Potential employers and others are checking Facebook, and so there's all this so-called digital litter that's out there that people may not realize it are there, but searches can turn up.
But of course, that's been an issue before too. Anybody who's savvy, who is in human resources, may have a Facebook account anyway.
Absolutely, and more all the time. It's interesting how critical a lot of the Facebook and MySpace pages, Flickr, some of the photography sites, Krannert Center here locally just finished up the Wall to Wall Guitar Festival. And there was a panel discussion among a number of the artists about technology and how important it was to maintain a presence on places like Facebook and MySpace and such, and yet at the same time, how hard it was to keep track with all of that. keep track of all of it and keep it all updated. So and this is just another reason to make sure that what you've got there is what you want people, not necessarily just your friends, to see.
So the rule of thumb is don't put anything up that you wouldn't want your mom to see or something or you know, and that's a fine line because, so you, like you said, there are musicians that use MySpace is almost sort of a way to promote their careers.
And in fact, in some cases, it's as a number of artists move away from record labels in the traditional distribution mode, that's pretty much the only way, Facebook and the other MySpace and the other social networking sites.
So you've got to make that balance and hopefully, and I guess that means also screening responses that come into your site too. Somebody may do the embarrassment for you.
Yeah. There's just no end to it. And so... you know, a number of these artists that I was referring to a moment ago have friends or colleagues who will spend an hour or two a day just perusing their various responses and other materials on their Facebook, MySpace, trying to keep it updated.
Or just being online is a full-time job anymore.
It is. Or full-time and a half, which is the problem.
Well, Peter Kimball's full-time job is at the University of Illinois. He is a lead faculty trainer for the Fast 3 Consortium, and he comes in every other month to answer your computer questions on the Afternoon Magazine. And, Peter, we thank you for another job well done.
It's always a pleasure, and I'll look forward to coming back probably the week before Thanksgiving.
All right. We'll look forward to seeing you there. I'm sure Celeste will be here, or maybe not.
Well, I'll see
I'm sure it will be me if it's not Celeste. But thanks again.